Accession number 12279, Reel 2.
Captain Brown, Reel 2.
Well, my own personal feelings towards the U-boat crews was not one of hatred, but it was certainly one of a determination to eliminate them, because they were a deadly menace to us in the convoy, and of course they could cause tremendous loss of life, as indeed eventually they did in our own aircraft carrier. So there was no love lost for them.
Do you think that the crews would have been ill-treated on capture?
The U-boat crews?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think so. Once the combat is over, so to speak, that the U-boat has been sunk or captured, then I don't think you find that general animosity towards the crew. I think suddenly one realizes you have a set of human beings who've been fighting for their country just as you're fighting for yours, and I wouldn't say you have a lot of sympathy for them, but I think you have to show what I might call soldierly camaraderie towards them.
Was OG-76 your first convoy?
No, 74. OG-74 and HG-74. And this was the second one. 76 out and 76 back.
How did 74 compare with 76?
Oh, 74 was much quieter, in the sense that we only had one courier attack during that convoy. And it was a nasty attack. We had a rescue hospital ship called the Walmer Castle, and we also had a rescue tug called the Thames, and we'd had some U-boat activity the night before, which caused one or two sinkings, and the Walmer Castle and the Thames were had left the convoy looking for survivors to pick them up. In fact, they had picked up some badly hurt survivors when this courier came in and attacked them. Now, this was very bad, because the Walmer Castle clearly, very clearly, had a huge red cross painted on its upper deck. And but nevertheless, she was bombed by the courier and indeed set on fire, and the ship was lost, with most of the wounded people aboard, or many of the wounded people aboard, before some of them were rescued, but some not. And just after she had released her bombs, our two Wildcats, a section of Wildcats, well, I wasn't in the section, but the two of them came in and killed it off. So that was our first occurrence. And also there had been an attack prior to that on a courier by the commanding officer and his number two, and he was killed in this attack. So we lost our CO on the way out on OG. Now that was on, I beg your pardon, that was on OG-70. Now that was, I think it was on 74. You're taxing my memory here. I know mine were on the 76, and I know that the Walmer Castle was on 74, but I think the other U-boat attack was also in 74. But we lost the commanding officer anyway. He had made a successful attack, set the aircraft on fire, and unfortunately, instead of breaking away totally, his number two said that he came in and more or less to have a look at whether the thing was actually finished or not. He came too close. It got within range of the gunner. The upper dorsal gunner started opening fire, so he immediately banked away to get out of range, but he was hit on the belly of the aircraft just as he banked away.
What was morale in the squadron like during combat?
Oh, sky high. When you were actually doing something as opposed to sitting around waiting for it to happen, I think everybody's spirits rose enormously. And the ground crew, if you call them that, the maintenance personnel, were great chaps. They were terribly joyous about the whole thing, because there was a bit of rivalry going on, whether it was the aircraft that the section that you serviced who were in action or the other side. And I think probably a lot of bets changed hands amongst the ground crew, this sort of thing. But when one came back from a successful convoy, the ground crew went mad with joy, and there really was a tremendous camaraderie between the pilots and the servicing personnel.
In the RAF, they sometimes talked about lack of moral fibre for people. Did you ever come across that phenomenon?
Not in my experience, no.
Did you ever know the phrase in the war?
Oh, I remember the phrase well. Indeed I do. Yes, indeed I do. I can't say I ever came across it in the war, nope. In fact, I would say the reverse was what I came across, that people were almost, should we say, had an almost kamikaze attitude to getting on with the fight. I never saw anybody show the slightest reluctance to get involved at all. I think when you're very young, you tend to have a rather suicidal approach to life. It's clear when you see the way motorcyclists behave, and young motorcyclists and young people generally don't show a lot of fear. I think this is possibly because it's lack of imagination. As you get older, of course, I think your attitude changes and life becomes slightly more precious, and your experience makes you realize that you have to weigh up the odds a bit more carefully. When you're young, you don't think of any odds at all. You just think you're the one that's going to make it. You never think of yourself as going to be killed. And I haven't met many people that brooded on the war. I have heard of people that did have this, but I haven't actually met any.
So do I understand that you're all eager to get into combat?
All of us? Or are you talking about me personally?
You and your comrades?
Well, all
as
of
well.
Us, yes. I would say every one of us, we talked about it all every minute of every hour of the day, practically, yes. We exchanged views, we exchanged tactics on what we would do if it happened, and because we were trying to cover ourselves as much as possible with our minimal experience, we were trying to find it amongst ourselves. And we used to quiz the CO all the time before he was killed. And then when he was killed, we reflected very, very deeply on that. I would say that was the one time when we didn't brood, but we reflected very deeply on what the odds were, and whether our tactics were right. But when we heard what had actually happened from his number two, I think we were a little less worried about the situation, less concerned.
What happened to the squadron after HG-76?
Well, it was reformed. We lost a lot of the pilots when the Audacity was sunk. In fact, we lost two... I would say, I'm just trying to calculate, certainly about a third of the pilots, if not more. And thereafter, It was reformed with the same commanding officer who had replaced our original commanding officer, and we had Hurricanes as opposed to Wildcats.
We haven't put on tape about the sinking of the Audacity. If we can go through that step by step in detail, please.
Yes, well, this happened on the night of the 21st of December 1941 in HG 76. And we had set out from Gibraltar, and I think we'd only been about 2 days out when the first attacks started. And it was quite obvious that we had a pack of U-boats concentrated against us. And there was a lot of activity, both in the air and on the surface. And Walker's escorts, in fact, had a very, very busy time indeed. We had quite a lot of sightings, and in fact, we lost one of our Wildcats to a U-boat. One of the Wildcats spotted a U-boat on the surface and attacked him, and the U-boat shot it down. So we lost one that way.
Did you see that?
Pardon?
Did you actually see that?
Oh, no, I didn't, nope. No, but it was seen by some of the escort vessels, but I personally didn't see it. It was a bit out away from the carrier, but one of the escort vessels who recovered his body, I think it was Walker's own ship, recovered the pilot's body. And anyway, we realized that it was very heavy, so we were stepping up our patrols to our anti-submarine patrols. And I was on the very last anti-submarine patrol that evening with my section leader, and we left it rather late, in fact, because they wanted to keep us up as long as possible, and we were kept up much later than one normally was accustomed to. And when we came back, it really was dusk. And the ship was heaving a little bit, not too bad, but we had to land on in the evening, and it was really half light by this time. In fact, the batsman who waved us on was standing with a couple of torches as opposed to the normal paddles he had. And that shows you that the light was fading considerably. And my section leader went round, and he landed on, and I was the very last, therefore, to land on. I landed after him. And about, not much more than about 30 to 40 minutes after that, I was sitting at having some coffee in the wardroom when the explosion hit. And what had happened, the torpedo had been fired at us and it struck the rudder of the ship. We had a single rudder, and we only had, I should tell you, a top speed of 14 knots. Now, the aircraft carrier had in fact left the convoy. And the strategic reason for this was that we had five lanes of ships in the convoy, and normally the Audacity at night was stuck right in the middle of the middle lane, so that she had maximum protection round her, that if any torpedoes were fired, it wouldn't hit the carrier, because this was the main daylight protection for the convoy. But it was felt the convoy was so slow and there were so many U-boats around that a decision was made that night that the Audacity should leave the convoy and zigzag by herself, not too far away, but at full speed, her full 14 knots. Now, the convoy was only about a 10-knot convoy, so it made that little bit of difference. And it was while we were doing this zigzag that this random torpedo was fired at us and took off the rudder. Well, of course, when we lost our rudder, we no control on the zigzag whatsoever. So the captain had to make the horrid decision to heave to while we assessed this situation. And, of course, the escort, he had warned the Commodore what had happened. The escorts were rushing towards us. But while we were stopped, absolutely stark still in the water, and suddenly we could see on the port side a U-boat surfacing. You could see it because it was dark, but it was the phosphorescence that was covered in phosphorescence. And tremendous glow as this thing rose. It was quite eerie. And we could actually also see the commander, U-boat commander, on the conning tower. You could see his hat. So they were as close as that when they came up. It was the U-571, commanded, as we find out, obviously later, by Oberleutnant Biegauk. And there was this tremendous hiatus while we stood looking at each other. And then somebody's nerve cracked, and they opened fire with a 20mm cannon, which was like using a pea shooter, really, against this thing. But it was the catalyst for what happened afterwards, because this fellow opened fire against it, and within seconds, we had four torpedoes rushing towards us. You could see them quite clearly. They left quite a noticeable trace in the water. And they all four struck us. And the complete bows of the ship fell off. They literally just vanished. About a third of the ship seemed to just disappear. And as it did, then the real chaos started, because the captain, quite sensibly, when we had been stopped, had assembled the entire crew, apart from those that were at specific stations, such as in the engine room, on the flight deck. So we were all up there on the flight deck, all wearing our Mae Wests or the equivalent which the merchant seamen had. And so there were about 400 odd people up on the flight deck. And when the bows fell off, some of them went with that. But the worst thing that happened was immediately the bows went, the ship's tilted very, very steeply, nose down. And the martlets at the back, there were, I think at that time we had risen from 6 in the earlier convoy to 8 on board, and they all broke their moorings. They were all tied down, held down by steel hawsers, but they all broke theirs, and the entire number of aircraft just rushed down the flight deck. And of course, with that number of people on it, it just scattered people right, left and centre. A lot of them were hit by the machines or swept off of the sides of the machines. I saw them coming like many others, and I just jumped over the side. And you're talking about a jump. I don't know how high it would be, but it certainly must have been at least 50 feet, not more. But we could not. I mean, it was that or get wiped off. So I think many people were killed in the jump. A lot of people jumped on top of the people in the water already. And, you know, that's always a nasty thing, but it usually means both get killed in the end. But that's certainly how I finished up in the water, by just jumping off the flight deck.
Were people dropping in all around you?
Oh, yes, right, left and centre. And I think we lost a lot of the crew. I think we lost well over a third of the crew.
Did you see any collisions between people?
Jumping onto each other? Oh, yes, yes, quite a few. Anyway, she continued to go nose down and, of course, sank pretty rapidly.
How How far had you managed to get away from the carrier before she sank?
Well, we were all striking out like mad in case we were sucked under. That was the great worry. But last I looked up, the captain was still on we didn't have a bridge as such. We had a small, looked like almost a steel box on each side of the carrier's deck, and he was in the starboard side there, and he was still there when I last looked back, and she had heeled at quite an angle then. But in fact, he got clear of it eventually, but I think he probably went in with it and was swept out of his bridge. He didn't survive, as a fact, because he was lost as they were trying to pick him up later on. But well, not later on, very soon after this incident. But he was lost. Now, I managed to contact my section leader, because we'd both more or less. Funny how you have this way of sticking together when you're in a section, but we always seem to be together doing everything, and we both jumped over together, and we tied ourselves together this was later. First, I should say, we were swimming together because we saw corvettes coming towards us and they began picking up people, quite a lot of people. And we were just unfortunate that the area where we were wasn't the first area they came to. And they picked up a huge number of people when suddenly they made off. And we found ourselves, we weren't too worried because we thought, well, they'll be back very shortly. And we tied ourselves together along with about 20 seamen who were also in the water. Now, we were wearing Mae West, and they were just wearing this sort of rubber tire with tapes over it. And we didn't know till later that the reason the corvettes had taken off was that they had had an ASDIC ping. So there was a submarine still in the area, and they could not afford, with all the overladen as they were with people, to be attacked. So that's the reason they left us. Well, we were actually, the 22 of us, roughly, were tied up together. We were actually in the water 6 hours before they did come back. And by that time, the 20 seamen who were not equipped with Mae West, just these rubber tube things, they had all gone. They had got exhausted and fallen forward, face down, into the water and just drowned. And there wasn't much we could do about it. We were all a bit exhausted and weak by this time anyway. So after about 6 hours total in the water, we saw one of the corvettes coming towards us again, much to our delight. At that stage, we were getting a little weary. And it came alongside, threw ropes over, and we were hauled in. And it was only when I got on the deck of the corvette that I realized that the time in the water had taken quite a toll of us, because we couldn't stand upright on the deck. Of course, there were only two of us, as I say. But at the same time, I learned that our captain had been seen by one of the corvettes. This was much earlier, just after the sinking. And he had been thrown a rope, and as he was being hauled in, the rope unfortunately snapped, and he fell forward and struck his head on the hull of the vessel and fell back into the sea and vanished. So it was a most unfortunate end for a very, very gallant man.
Whilst you were in the sea, had you tended to give up hope?
It passed across my mind, I have to confess, that it's an awful large expanse of water, and when you see absolutely nothing on it except two bobbing heads, your own and somebody else's, you tend to have thoughts in that direction. But quite frankly, after a while, even your thinking senses get numbed, and you're really not thinking about anything. You're just in a semi-coma, really.
How cold is it?
Well, 21st December, right out in the Bay of Biscay, it wasn't as cold as I had anticipated, to be frank. The fact that we survived for that amount of time proves that, of course, and it may well be that part of the Gulf Stream goes through there. I really don't know, but it certainly wasn't quite as bad as I had anticipated.
Did you ever learn anything about why the U-boat captain should have hesitated before finishing the ship off?
No, I didn't. He gave an interview afterwards, and he didn't mention this pause. Of course, I think to put it in perspective, when you're all tense on a flight deck waiting for something to happen, it probably seemed like eternity to us, but it may have been a matter of seconds, or maybe I wouldn't have thought it was more than, certainly not more than a minute. And if the chap who fired the gun hadn't done so, how long it would have gone on after that, I don't know, but I suspect he was just sizing up the situation before making the coup de grace.
If we can go back to the narrative, you said that the squadron was reformed with Hurricanes in 42.
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, it, as I say, it formed up with Hurricanes, and it eventually went to another carrier, but in the interim, I left the squadron to become a test pilot. But somebody had, I presume, at some stage, probably the captain of the Audacity, before it was sunk, had informed the Admiralty that I had seemed to have a particular skill at deck landing, and that maybe they should use this in trial situations. And this is, in fact, what happened to me. I suddenly found myself pulled out of the squadron, put onto trials work on aircraft carriers, and, of course, eventually I became, a later stage in my service career, a full-time test pilot.
When was that?
Well, I was in a service trials unit for quite a while, I think in about 42-43, and then I went to the test squadron at Boscombe Down at the end of 43, and then in January of 1944, I was suddenly appointed as the chief naval test pilot to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough, where I stayed for 6 years.